Good morning. On today's programme, how Australians are being warned of winter blackouts as an energy crisis hits the East Coast, and how independent bookshops are thriving in France thanks to a 30-year-old law. But first, a tale of diplomatic brinksmanship. Turkey took its NATO colleagues on a roller coaster ride this past week. The issue was Sweden's and Finland's application to join the military alliance. Turkey had threatened to veto the application, but the country's president changed his mind this week after a persuasive intervention from the US President Joe Biden, as Jasper Mortimer reports from Istanbul.
Turkey made two U-turns in 5 days last week. The week began with it saying that unless Sweden and Finland agreed to extradite the militants it wanted, Turkey would block their joining NATO at the Madrid summit. Turkey could do this, as all of NATO's 30 countries have the right to veto a new member. On Tuesday night, Turkey dropped its objections and agreed to Sweden and Finland's joining the alliance. It said the Nordic countries had given it what it wanted. In Turkey, the pro-government press headlined what it called the Madrid victory of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The Minister of Justice said he expected Sweden and Finland to extradite 33 militants. But by the end of the week, President Erdogan was saying Sweden had promised to extradite 73 militants. The sudden jump in numbers was not explained. And if it didn't do so, then the Turkish parliament wouldn't ratify Sweden and Finland's joining NATO, meaning the whole deal would collapse. We don't know exactly what happened, but there are clues. When Erdogan announced his opposition to Swedish and Finnish membership on May the 13th, he took NATO by surprise. The NATO states had applied to join because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, an attack condemned by a legion of countries, including Turkey. When the Turkish official news agency published a list of the militants that Erdogan accused Sweden and Finland of harboring, it was pointed out that one of the militants had died 5 years ago. The list seemed to have been put together in a hurry. Erdogan is an astute politician. He knows what his supporters like. He's unpopular at the moment because the economy is in the doldrums. Yet the Metropole polling agency found Erdogan's popularity climbed 4 points in May. His supporters admire a man who can stand alone against the world. So Turkey's opposition to Swedish and Finnish membership grew stronger. On Tuesday, the eve of the Madrid summit, Erdogan sat down with the President of Finland and the Prime Minister of Sweden in a meeting convened by the NATO Secretary General. Afterwards, Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson said some progress had been made, but President Sauli Niinistö said he was neither pessimistic nor optimistic about the chance of Finland's joining. Then US President Joe Biden had a word with Erdogan. America produces something that Turkey wants much more than a bunch of militants: F-16 fighter bombers. In October, Turkey asked to buy 40 F-16s, as well as modernization kits to upgrade about 80 planes in its air force. The deal is now waiting for approval by the US Congress, where Erdogan has many enemies because of his purchase of Russian anti-aircraft missiles. Biden knows the Congress very well. We don't know what he told Erdogan on Tuesday, but it's highly likely he would have assured him there was no chance of Congress approving the sale of F-16s if Turkey stopped Sweden and Finland from joining NATO. What we do know is that when Erdogan resumed talks with the Swedes and the Finns later on Tuesday, he agreed to their joining the alliance. The agreement was written down and signed. Neither side wanted any backsliding. In Turkey, a pro-government newspaper trumpeted, "Two strongholds of terrorism fall in Europe." But opposition politicians pointed out the agreement made no commitments on extradition. A German political analyst, Minna Elender, told the Guardian newspaper that the deal was so carefully worded that, quote, "both sides can read into it what they want." Under pressure, Erdogan said Sweden had to extradite 73 militants or Turkey wouldn't ratify the membership agreement. But there are two deals waiting ratification. The second one is in the US Congress. Erdogan will have to make a choice. He can either block Swedish and Finnish membership, or he can buy the F-16s. He cannot do both. This is Jasper Mortimer for World Report in Istanbul.
To Australia next, where citizens of that country are being warned of winter blackouts as an electricity shortage hits the heavily populated East Coast. The Federal Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, says supplies will remain unpredictable for some time to come. Regulators have used emergency provisions to prevent power cuts as demand surges in unseasonably cold weather and because of shortages of coal and gas. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australians are being urged to conserve electricity as many approach the coldest months of the year. It's the first time households in the most populous state, New South Wales, have been asked to ration heating and turn off appliances since the energy crunch hit in May. Prices have soared, and the operator in Australia's electricity market has stepped in to impose a cap. This has led to some generating companies to withhold supply because they claim that capped prices don't cover their costs. But those firms have been ordered to keep the lights on and avert blackouts in New South Wales and Queensland by delivering enough energy to power almost 4 million homes. The electricity generators will receive compensation to cover their costs. But for many Australians, there's uncertainty about the reliability of supplies as winter takes hold. The war in Ukraine has affected the global market for fossil fuels, increasing scarcity and producing record high prices. That's coincided in Australia with planned and unplanned outages at coal-fired power stations, along with a cold snap that's seen a surge in demand by households. There were periods too of low wind and solar output. The entire system has creaked and has threatened in places to fall apart. Coal-fired plants normally provide 65% of Eastern Australia's power supply, but more than a quarter of that capacity is currently unavailable. To make up for it, the market has had to rely on gas and diesel at a time when their prices have also skyrocketed. There's little the new government in Canberra can do. It's being encouraged to divert exports of natural gas for domestic use, but that could harm Australia's reputation as a major international producer. Restricting exports already happens in Western Australia, but not in the more populated eastern states. Coal and gas generate most of Australia's energy. There was a reluctance under the previous centre-right government to embrace renewables. Coal was always king and queen. There's plenty of it, and selling it to other countries has generated huge amounts of revenue for Australia. But increasingly there's a realisation that the industry is in terminal decline. Ministers say the power crisis should accelerate Australia's transition to green energy. Last year, solar, wind and hydro produced about a third of the country's electricity. Rising bills and environmental awareness are driving unstoppable change. Australia has the highest use of solar energy anywhere in the world. Harnessing the power of the sun, the wind and water for hydroelectricity is essential in a country that's on the front line of climate change. For years, scientists have warned that global warming would exacerbate floods, fires, droughts and storms in Australia, the world's driest inhabited continent. They said too that heat waves, the deadliest of all natural hazards, would also get worse. The new Labour government is promising to reduce emissions by 43% by 2030. But many environmentalists believe Australia needs to be far more ambitious as it moves away from fossil fuels. For World Report, this is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Finally, we go to France. The French Librairie isn't a library, but a bookshop. And in spite of the rise of giant online bookshops, the Librairie still holds a strong place in the hearts and minds of a nation with a voracious appetite for books and which is, according to some, the cradle of the modern novel. Instrumental in the survival of the bookshop is a law brought in 30 years ago by a forward-looking culture minister, as Connor Power reports now from Nice.
On the Rue d'Effly in Nice, there's a bookshop and bar called Les Parleuses, a wonderful combination that allows one to simultaneously enjoy the pleasure of having a drink at a French terrace in the sultry Mediterranean air while reading a book, surrounded by even more books. Books still have a special place in France, says Maud Pouillet, who, along with her partner Anouk Aubert, has owned Les Parleuses for the last 3.5 years. Standing behind the bar amidst a sea of books, she cuts a vaguely heroic presence, like the leader perhaps of a revolution fighting back against the onslaught of mass distribution. And they're not alone. From walking around this district of central Nice, close to the Modern Art Museum, I know that there are at least 5 other bookshops, or librairies, within a couple of minutes' walk of here. French people read far more books than most other nationalities. By way of comparison, Ireland has just had a bumper year of book reading. Our population of 5 million souls purchased an impressive 13.1 million books last year. If France's population of 67 million were on the same book reading level as we are, then they should have purchased somewhere in the region of 176 million books last year. But they didn't. They bought over 420 million. Christophe Gardet is sales director with Géodif, part of the iRoll Group, a Paris-based publisher, distributor, and owner of one of France's largest independent bookstores on the Boulevard Saint-Germain. Christophe's perspective is a uniquely nationwide one, talking to bookshop owners all across the country every week. What has really saved books and bookshops is that we have the Loi Long, he says, referring to the law introduced by Jack Long, one of the most influential ministers of culture that France has known. During his 1998-92 tenure, he introduced the Prix Unique, a uniform price for books that couldn't be reduced by any more than 5%. It means, says Christophe, that it doesn't matter where you buy the book, on Amazon, Fnac, in an Auchan hypermarket, or in a bookshop, you pay the very same price. That has preserved the independent bookshops in France who, without this law, would have disappeared. There were already large mail-order and online book suppliers in France, but the arrival of Amazon in the French books market made an enormous impact, as the American company has done everywhere else. Today it is the largest distributor of books in France, having achieved this without being able to undercut competitors as they have been able to do in other countries. However, Amazon did offer its customers free shipping costs. Naturally, the representatives of the French bookshops cried foul to this move by Bezos and company, accusing them of price reduction by stealth. When a law was brought into force in July 2014 to legally oblige Amazon and any other book distributor to charge a delivery fee, the American company neatly sidestepped the issue by charging just 1 cent for any delivery. After such a debacle, bookshops in France realized that they weren't going to win the war against mega-distribution on their terms. They began to fight back in a smart way, realizing that their big advantage over mail-order behemoths was that they were physical presences in real communities, centers of cultural and social importance, if you like. Another measure that has tipped the balance in favor of book sales, and comic book shops in particular, is the introduction of the Passe Culture, a culture pass that gives a €300 voucher to 18-year-olds to spend at their local bookshops, buying anything from 19th-century literature to 21st-century manga comics. The sense of appreciation of bookshops has been bolstered by the sense of national unity that the lockdowns brought. Bookshops have become, more than ever, places of social and cultural interaction, where authors come to launch their books and meet their readers. Back at Les Parleuses, the evening sun casts warm colours along Rue d'Effly. Another successful book launch has drawn a good-natured, mixed crowd. Children leaf through their newly purchased books, whilst adults chat animatedly around a table in the summer air. At some tables, people enjoy an aperitif drink while lost in the latest novel by Alice Zeniter or the latest translation of a Claire Keegan novel. It's as representative a snapshot as any of the great French librairie, very much alive and thriving at the heart of the community. For RTE World Report in Nice, southern France, this is Connor Power.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.